Again, we're glad you're here. We are continuing in the book of Esther. We've already spent a couple of weeks kind of getting some of the background. We see that there was a king there. In some of the translations, he's called King Xerxes. And other translations use his other name, which is Ahasuerus. And so he was a mighty man, kind of ruling a large area of land, a lot of money, large armies. And in chapter 1, his wife, who was the queen, did some things that displeased him. She didn't come when she was called, and so he was embarrassed, and he was at a drinking party with his buddies, and so it didn't turn out very well, and so they decided that she was no longer going to be queen. And then last week, we found out that he thought, well, I do need a queen. Can't live forever without this woman. I'm sure he had a lot of other women on the side. It's just the way they did it back then. And if you're familiar with your Bible, you also know it wasn't just the people that lived in places like Babylon or Egypt or Persia, but it's also people that were the children of God that did not always live morally. But eventually they decided we need a new queen. So they had a beauty contest, and this queen called Esther was the one who was chosen. And she would be someone that would be from the background of the Jewish people. And so she was being mentored and continued to be under the care, we would say, of her cousin. His name was Mordecai, and her parents died when she was young. And so he was the one who was still giving her advice. And she was probably still a fairly young woman, maybe even a teenager. And so she was listening to things that he had to say as she was kind of understanding what she needed to do, what her role was, and that kind of thing. One thing we did find out, though, he did tell her that she should not reveal her heritage, that she was from the ancestry of the Jewish nation. And we're going to find out as the story continues to unfold. We're mostly going to be here just in chapter 3. And we're going to come upon a man who had a plot. And we find some things that are uncovered here that maybe sometimes we might look over. But now this man's name, his name was Haman. And so I've called this, the title is, Haman, Stop It. So I don't know if a lot of people said, hey man, and every time somebody said it, he looks, it's like, they're calling me. It's like, no, we're just calling a generic person. But anyway, so yeah, here's somebody that came up with an evil plot. I mean, he got a little bit upset about some things, and we can kind of see the extreme that some people go to when they have a lot of power, when they have control. Maybe we say they even have control issues, and maybe they think they're larger than what they really are. But we see how things begin to come together. And as we read through, it's kind of a lesson and a story that's building, and you don't really want to miss the details. So last time we looked at chapter 2, but we didn't want to leave the last few verses of chapter 2 out because some things happened there with Mordecai. And so he overheard some conversations. So during the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, and this may mean that he did have some kind of a position himself in the kingdom, that maybe he was a political advisor, that maybe he was some kind of a small-time judge. Because sitting at the king's gate seemed to imply that he was there ready to work on behalf of the nation. And if you're familiar again with what the people of Israel were told when they went into Babylon, which is, they're not really into Babylon now because it was taken over by the Medes and the Persians, so it's called Persia now, but when they went into Babylon, it said to seek the welfare of the city. Because if the city prospers, you will prosper. So they weren't there to cause trouble. They weren't there to rebel against society. They weren't there to be opposed to everything. They were there to try to really get along in the situation they're in. And boy, that's a big challenge for us, that sometimes we live in a country or even a district or maybe even a work in a place where it's just not always easy. There seems to be a lot of problems. There's a lot of power manipulation. There's a lot of control people, and sometimes they ask us to do things that maybe we're not comfortable with. And well, what do we do in situations like this? There's a lot of things that can come up. But during the time when Mordecai was sitting by the gate, he overheard a conversation between the thugs, and actually these were pretty important thugs, Bigtha and Teresh, two of the king's officers. They guarded the doorway, and so this is a very important place and a position. I mean, they were really the last the last defense for the king. In other words, if you can get by these guys, you can get right to the king. And if you want to assassinate him, you can. So these are like the door guards. These are the guys that are looking out for the welfare and the safety of the king. So today we would almost say it would be like we overheard a conversation today between Joseph Clancy, who is the current director of the Secret Service, and John Brennan, who's the director of the CIA. And we've heard a conversation about some things that they were conspiring. What they had decided, they wanted to assassinate the king. So when you've got the people closest to the president, or in this case, to the king, and they're planning to assassinate him, you know you've got a lot of trouble. We find out a little bit about Mordecai here. Because a lot of people would say, well, Mordecai, he was just against everything. I mean, he was just mad he was there. And if he had an opportunity, oh no, what does he do? I mean, he could have kept his mouth shut and said, this is no business of mine. Boy, I hope it really works out. Hey, maybe they need a hand. I can get in on this and give them some advice. Because, hey, we are not really that happy with King Xerxes. Let's see him fall. But no, what does he do? He does the right thing. We're not going to read through it, but you can. He reports that to Esther. She's already the queen. She's already, the wife to the king. And he tells her about what's going to happen, about this plot, about a plan to assassinate. She goes and tells the king. He does the research. He does the investigation, finds out it's true, has these two guys killed, and apparently some other guys probably appointed to the position. And so just think about this. Your life has literally been saved. And Esther even told the king, it was Mordecai who found this out. He was the one who revealed the plot. I mean, he's the hero of the day. And so King Xerxes says, well, this is great. Let's just write it down in the Chronicles of the King. Okay, this is like you doing something so fantastic at work, and maybe you've single-handedly saved the company, brought in several new accounts worth millions of dollars. You are definitely outperforming everyone else. And so the CEO says, well, maybe we will put you in page 231 in the annual report saying, you've done a good job. You think, are you kidding me? I don't get more recognition than just a couple lines in the Chronicles of the King? Well, I mean, really, how do you feel when you get looked over? When you think I've done the best I could do, and not only that, it worked out very well for everybody, and nobody notices. Nobody cares. There's no recognition. I mean, it's hardly even a thanks. It's easy to get a bad attitude. But Mordecai continues to do what he needs to do, even though he's overlooked. Now, there's another man that's kind of rising up through the ranks. We find out who he is at the beginning of chapter 3. His name is Haman. So after these events, the king of Xerxes honored Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating Haman, giving him a seat of honor higher than all of the other nobles. So he was promoted to what we would say the vice president or the prime minister. I mean, he would almost be like what Joseph was in the days of Pharaoh. I mean, he was over everything, really. The king kind of gave him the authority and the power and said, you can run the kingdom. I'm the king. I mean, I'm too busy, concerned about my parties and my women and just all that other stuff. I don't want to run a kingdom. I'm going to give it to you. Just do a good job. Run the kingdom. Make me look good. I've got the position as far as the title. I just want you to do a good job. You do all the work. So this is who this man was. And so we read through this really quickly because there's a bunch of names we don't really understand, but we find out one thing, that he was an Agagite. What does that mean? Well, I don't know. An Agagite. What possibly? Why would we even put that in there? And I think I know why. Because these are just hard words to pronounce. And sometimes you just pepper the Bible with just such difficult words. And then maybe when you're done doing the Bible reading of the day, that people say, oh, you did a good job. You kind of made it through at least half of the words and pronounced them rightly. Right? Oh, no, I think there's more to it. And Agagite means that he came from the lineage of a man named Agag. Oh, hang on. That sounds a little familiar. Doesn't that sound familiar to Agag? Who was Agag? Oh, he was a king. He was a king many years earlier. As a matter of fact, during the days of Saul, this Agag. You remember 1 Samuel chapter 15, Samuel was told to go to the Amalekites and to kill everybody. To kill the entire nation. To kill the princes all the way down to the babies. The men and the women. The children, everyone was to be killed when they went into this battle. And so God clearly says, go and attack the Amalekites, totally destroy everything that belongs to them, do not spare them, put to death the men, the women, the children, the infants, the cattle, the sheep, the camels, dogs, everything. It's very clear what Saul, he was the king of Israel. That's what they were to do. Now, I like King Saul to some degree because he's a very pragmatic person. I mean, he comes up with some good ideas. And here's a really good idea. We don't need to put everybody to death because we can use some of these people. We can use some of these animals. As a matter of fact, we can use some of the animals to offer up sacrifices to God. We can keep the king of Agag as our trophy. I mean, this is just going to look really good on my resume, you know, because who doesn't like a couple good photo shoots, you know? As long as someone doesn't come and do the photo bomb, you know, we can just get a good shot. We can post it on Facebook. Look what I've done. We had a great day, right? So this is what he does. Makes a big deal of it. But that's not what God told him to do. So we find out, 1 Samuel 15, verse 8, this is what Saul did. Saul took, King Saul, he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. And all of his people he destroyed with a sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag, the best of the sheep and the cattle and the fat of the calves and the lambs and everything that was good. Samuel comes along and confronts him. He's like, oh no, I did exactly what the Lord told me to do. And Samuel says, really? I mean, I'm hearing some sheep. You know, I kind of see what's going on here. You didn't obey. You didn't obey. As a matter of fact, to obey is better than sacrifice. But you read through this and you think, well, what's the deal? Why is God like this? Why did he make such a big deal about the Amalekites and this King Agag? Is that a big deal? Well, if we could go back just a few generations earlier, all the way back to the days of Moses. Here they are leaving Egypt, made it through the Red Sea, and they're on their way to the Promised Land. And here in Exodus 17, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men, go and fight the Amalekites. And tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. And you remember the story, if you saw the movie, right? And that's when Moses was holding up his staff and the people of Israel, they're winning. Oh, but Moses got tired after a while and staff started falling down and the Israelites started losing. And then he put it up, they win. But you get tired after a while. So you remember Ben-Hur, you know, that guy, you know, and then Joshua, they come along and they help him hold up his hand so it doesn't tire. And as long as the staff was up in the air, Israelites won and they defeated the Amalekites. What happened here, they were leaving and they were kind of tired as they were journeying along and the Amalekites came and tried to attack them at their weakest point. They weren't trained warriors. As a matter of fact, they came up from behind and tried to attack, you know, perhaps we would even say the women and the children, the people that were not at the forefront. And so they're really trying to take advantage of the situation. And so God does say something else about this in Deuteronomy chapter 25. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all of the enemies around you in the land he's given you, when you get to the Promised Land, when you get into Jericho, when you get into, you settle in, and he's going to give you to possess as his inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. This is why it was such a big deal for Saul to disobey. I mean, God had a plan generations earlier. And even if Saul had read his Bible, he would have known this. But no, Saul comes up with a better idea than to do exactly what God says. And that is a problem. Do you see what the problem is? Because there's a problem for us today. Because sometimes God says things so clearly and we say, boy, that's a good idea, God. And I think there's a lot of people that should be doing that. But I got a better idea. I got something different. I mean, I don't know if you know me that well, but, you know, I'm just not that much of a compliant person. I mean, I'm kind of more of an emotional person. Or I'm kind of someone who just kind of, hey, we will just kind of change things and adjust things. We'll change up the program as we go along, just to see how it goes, just to see how it fits, to see, hey, is everybody really happy? But it's so important to do what God says. In Numbers chapter 33 and verse 55, this is another thing that God says. If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. They will give you trouble in the land where you live. If you're not going to do what I tell you to do, God says, you're going to have problems. Can I tell you there's going to be some consequences? This is going to affect, it's not going to affect just you. It's going to affect some other people. Oh, and so oftentimes we think that. Oh, what I do is just between me and maybe whoever I'm doing it with. Or maybe I'm quite frankly sinning. It's just, you know, I'm not really involving other people. It's just me. And God says, no, no, no. What you do affects other people. As a matter of fact, God would go on to say in Exodus chapter 20 when he's giving the law, where he talks about not bowing down to the other idols and worshiping them. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Look what he says. Punishing the children for the sins of their father to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. First of all, he's saying, if you disobey me and you start bowing down to other things that call themselves gods or are elevated by others as gods, if you bow down to them, God says, you're hating me. Oh, we don't think of it that way. We just think, well, you know, God may not be too happy, but he understands. I mean, God is kind of indifferent. He doesn't really care that much. He says, if you do this, you hate me. But there's consequences. And the consequences aren't just for you. Sometimes we think, I can do this and I can get away with it. It won't affect me at all. God says, you're a fool. Because it does not only just affect you, but it'll affect your children, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren. Now that's a lot of weight to bear when we talk about sin, isn't it? That should make us think twice about what's going to happen. This is what's happening in the days of Queen Esther. We have a problem because somebody disobeyed generations earlier. And the thing that becomes the gene and we make a rational decision based on we think of our genetics, it becomes generational. And it affects not only us, but those people around us. So we get to Esther chapter 2 with this guy named Haman, the Agagite, who actually should not even be alive if Saul had done what God told him to do. So all the royal officials at the king's gate, they knelt down and they paid honor to Haman. For the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. And we don't know what's going on here. Some people say, oh, Mordecai was just really proud. He didn't want to bow down to him. But we find out that obviously Mordecai did show respect and honor to the king. And he shows respect to other people. Now, other people would say, oh, it's not because he was too proud. It's just he didn't like Haman. He knew the history of Haman. Because Mordecai was a Jew. Haman was somebody that came from Agag and the Amalekites. Oh, he just didn't want to. He had an attitude. We don't know why. It may have been because this is kind of to do with the bowing down to worship. Just like the people in Babylon, they were told to bow down and worship. And you remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? We are not going to bow down to worship. We are not going to be worshiping the emperor as a god. And if you continue to find out more about this Haman guy, he really thought he was all that. I mean, he thought he was the most powerful. He could do whatever he want. He was very inflated with his own ego and his pride. So maybe this was more of bowing down as you would bow down to a god. For whatever reason, though, Mordecai would not bow down and pay him honor. He just refused to do it. So we don't have all the details, but we know what the outcome would be. Well, Haman's assistants and his administrators, they noticed this, that Mordecai was not bowing down. So they went to Haman and said, well, what are we going to do about that? He doesn't bow down. You need to take a stand. We're used to doing this. We can handle him. Verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, because Mordecai's already said the reason he does not bow down and pay homage is because he's a Jew. But now we find out, oh, if you're not going to honor me, I mean, he was mad. You say, how mad was he? Well, he was mad enough that he would do anything. He would do anything to at least make this a lesson for everybody else. Don't mess with me. So he was so angry, he came up with a plan. He came up with a plot. And we find out what he's planning on doing. So he was very upset. He was enraged, it says. He scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. So in other words, he thought, I can kill Mordecai, but that's not enough. I think that's just, we got to do more. There's something else that can be done. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. I mean, have you ever been that mad at somebody? I mean, in other words, things don't go very well. You don't have a really good conversation. Somebody kind of ticks you off because of something they said or something they did. I mean, it's not really that big of an infraction, but you're just not very happy. So you're thinking, well, we could kill him. I think some people should say, well, that's pretty extreme. Maybe, you know, maybe we could punish him, but you really think we should kill him? Yeah, I think we should kill him. But I don't think we should just kill him. I think we should kill his family. Kill his family? They've not even been involved in this. You're going to kill his entire family? No, I think I'm going to kill all of his relatives, too. The extended family. And now you're starting to think, wow, we've got a lunatic. He's a maniac. I mean, there's something wrong with this guy. Oh, no. Not just his family or his extended family. We're going to kill the entire nation. The entire nation of Israel, we are going to exterminate them. We're going to get rid of all of them. What kind of person would do that? Really, think about it. What kind of person would do that? What would drive a person to have that kind of reaction? And I can tell you, it's more than anger. It's more than he was displeased. It's because Satan filled his life. Satan was behind this. I mean, Mordecai was afraid, perhaps. Haman came up with this plot. It didn't originate in Haman's heart. This idea arranged and originated in the pit of hell. Because Satan has a plan. Well, it's not the first time Satan's had the plan, is it? You remember when they were in Egypt? What did Pharaoh want? Whose idea was that? Let's kill all of the baby boys. What's the point? What's the purpose? If we kill all of the baby boys, why would Pharaoh do that? Why wouldn't he kill all the babies? Because he still wanted a workforce. He still wanted to multiply. But if you think of you kill all the baby boys, after about 15 or 20 years, who are all these women, the teenagers and the young ladies, who are they going to be marrying? Oh, they'll be marrying the Egyptians. That makes sense. Because then when they get strong, they're not going to rebel and fight against Egypt because they're related. You know, my father's an Egyptian. My mother's an Israelite. We are not going to rebel. We are not going to go against Egypt. But that wasn't Pharaoh's idea. That was Satan's idea. Why would he care? Because if he could disrupt the seed, there's a promise in the seed, you remember? The seed back in Genesis chapter 3. The seed is, there's going to be a seed that comes along that is going to crush Satan's head. Oh, it's the seed from Abraham. It's the seed that is going to come that is going to bless all the nations. And if we can destroy the seed, that would never happen. It's only lunatics that do this type of thing. Don't you see it? But it comes from, did this happen again? Well, when Jesus was born, what happened when Jesus was born? Herod became so upset. He wanted to kill the baby. He heard it was going to be the Messiah. He heard it was going to be a king. The king of the Jews. That's ridiculous. He said, I'm going to kill the king. And when he found out that he couldn't kill the king, because he didn't know where the king was, what did he decide to do? We're going to kill all of the babies 2 years old and under. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of little boys being murdered, and they were murdered. Now, Jesus fled. He escaped with his parents, so he was not murdered. But what kind of lunatic would murder tens of thousands of people? Oh, because there's going to be a king coming out somewhere in there. We can get him. Who does that? It's not really Herod. That's Satan. He's trying to destroy God's plan. This is what's happening here. So Satan is going to be working through Haman. He's going to destroy all of the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. And so he is mad, and he's got a plan. And he's going to execute that plan just the way he wants. In verse 8, then Haman said to King Xerxes, so he thought, we'll get together with the king, and we'll just kind of tell him what's going on. And if you read through the lines here, you find out he's making up the story. He's telling out and out lies. He's trying to get the king to do what he wants. So he says, there's a certain people. Now, which people is this? The king doesn't know. It's not revealed. And the king doesn't even ask. Up to this point, the king doesn't even know his own wife, Queen Vashti, is from this line of people. But that doesn't matter anyway, because this people group was not even described. Who are they? We don't know. There's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from those of all the other people and who do not obey the king's law. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Wow. Now, how many people are we talking about? Well, we don't know because it seems like Haman is just kind of trying to keep it all secret. He's trying to say it's probably such a small group. If we lost them, you wouldn't even notice. You wouldn't even care. It would just be a little blip on the screen. I mean, why even bother with the details? Who are they? It's just the people. They just don't obey. They don't fit in. They're different. What are we going to do with them? Let's kill them. That's pretty strong language, isn't it? Let's kill them. See, it's not in the best interest to tolerate them. So King Xerxes thinks, well, I trust Haman. We're pretty powerful. We can do what we want. So let's go ahead and do that. But just in case Xerxes was not getting the point, Haman says this, if it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. Who's going to pay for all of this? It's going to cost a lot of money. And if you remember, we talked about last time that the empire has already lost a lot of money and a lot of manpower in the war against the Greeks. And now, here's an opportunity to get some more money. People have a hard time estimating how much money this is, but we're talking thousands, tens of thousands of tons of silver. So some people have estimated in our money, this would be close to $1 billion. Now, that's quite a gift. Some people say it's up to one-third of what the entire revenue was of the entire Persian Empire. It's a lot of money. Maybe this kind of helped Haman get the position in the first place. We kind of wonder, where did he come from? How does he all of a sudden get second in command? Well, money talks. And so, again, Xerxes probably thinks, well, obviously he really wants to do this, willing to put up this much money to give it to me to make sure this job gets done. Let's go ahead and do it. And so he gives him the authority and the power. This is what happens, that he gave him the signet ring. And this is what they say. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate. You know, they want to make sure we know what we're talking about here. I mean, how do you explain it to destroy, kill, and annihilate? It's going to be very clear what they want to do. All of the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, on the 12th month of the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. And as it worked out, what they were doing is that they were casting a lot to find out when they should do this. So they cast a lot. It came up to this day. This day was about, 9 or 10 months after the day they decided it. So there was a large window of time where people could have gotten ready to destroy the people. Maybe some of the Jews thought, well, we'll just leave, we'll escape before this happens. Maybe they were free to do that, or they could have snuck away. But the idea would be that if you went and killed your Jewish neighbor, then you got all that he had. You can get his house, you can get his furniture, you can get whatever he's got that you want. You can plunder his goods. So it becomes a good deal for the people that are willing to kill their Jewish neighbor so they can get what they want. And so this was the grand plan of Haman, that they will all be killed in just one day. And we're going to find out how this continues to work, because God is working behind the scenes. Again, if you read through the account, we find out that this decision and this letter would be written. It was done with the king's signet ring. What King Xerxes did is he just gave his ring to Haman, which is today like giving somebody a blank check. You give them the checking account, you sign your name, and you give it to him and say, you spend the money however you want. You have all the authority you need with a signet ring. And of course, the word signet and the word signature is very similar. He had the power of the king to do whatever he wanted. And so he was going to make all the plans. He was going to call all the plays. But this was actually done. It was done on the 13th day. All these letters would go out. The 13th day of the first month. The 13th day of the first month. And I don't know if there's any significance to that, except we do know that the 14th day of the first month is what? It's something they celebrate every year. The 14th day, the day after everybody's receiving these letters, the Jews are going to celebrate the Passover. We are going to remember when God freed Israel from Egypt. The Passover. We are going to remember the power and the grace of God. It's the Passover. We're going to celebrate Moses and him coming in to eat. We're going to remember the Passover. We're going to remember the lamb that was slain and the blood that was wiped on the doors. It's the Passover. And so the day before the Passover, here is this decree going out saying all of the Jews are going to die. And you think, I mean, could you imagine that Passover the next day? It would be a different Passover like they've ever had before. Because Passover is usually a time of celebration and remembering God and thanking God and telling the story. But what kind of story do you have to tell with a decree like this? So it becomes a real challenge for the Israelites. What do? Where do they turn? What hope? Could there be a deliverer anyway? So we end this chapter. And next time we'll find out what the plan is for Haman. I mean, his anger just continues to grow. As a matter of fact, he doesn't even want to wait all these months before he can kill Mordecai. He has a bigger plan for Mordecai. We're going to kill him publicly. And Haman wants to do it in his own backyard. So that's the story for next time about how God is going to be working behind the scenes. And so we can't forget some of the lessons we've learned today, because they all fit in next time. But here's the reaction of the people. Well, King Haman sat down to drink. Well, he had a problem, right? He was an alcoholic. He had a drinking problem. So what does that mean? Probably him and Haman, you know, a few other people. Hey, let's just all get together, you know. It's not a big deal. Let's just have a drink. Let's celebrate. Life goes on. Everything's good. We got power in the kingdom. We'll show these people we're in charge. I'll drink to that. Let's have a drink. But it's interesting. It just wasn't the Jewish people that were concerned and they were wondering and questioning. Like, what's going on here? It says, but the city of Susa, the people. What's happening? They're bewildered. Where did this come from? Whose idea was this? This is crazy. Who wants to do that? People are bewildered. They didn't see it. But bewildered may also be that they were concerned. They were concerned. Do you know why some people get concerned in times like this? Because you think, if Haman can do this to the Jews, what could he do to me? This is a problem that comes up a lot through history, doesn't it? What, it was about 1930s. who had a man named Hitler. And he thought, what was he trying to do? Oh, he was trying to annihilate all of the Jews. He's trying to kill them all. Continues today. But, you know, a lot of people stepped in to say, this is not right, we've got to stop it. But a lot of other people were saying, we've got to stop this, because if he's going to do that to them, then what's he going to do to us? Oh, it's not just going to stop with just one group. You give someone that much power and that much control, and their pride and their ego continues to grow and develop to that point. Nobody's safe. I don't care how you're related to the king. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care what your position is at work. I don't care how long you've lived in the city. Could be you next. This is a concern that the people had. And you wonder, how could this be turned around? Who could go and influence the king more than Mordecai? Well, he can't. What about Esther? We're going to find out. She doesn't see the king that often. Haman? The guy with the power, the money, the position, there's no stopping him. Unless God intervenes. We need a plan. And it's a plan we could never devise or construct. It's a divine plan. And God has a plan for us. So as we continue in the book of Esther, I hope that we can see that, yes, even God can use us. For such a time as this, that maybe there's things that he wants to do in our life that make a difference in a community. It makes a difference in a workplace. It makes a difference in one person's life. It makes a difference with your children or your grandchildren. Or maybe it's your spouse or your parents. It makes a difference not only for the life or for the comfort or for the welfare of the people you live with, but for their soul. That's what we're talking about, aren't we? Because if all the Jews are annihilated, God's plan is defeated, there would be no Messiah. We would all be lost. We wouldn't be here today, not doing this. We may be doing other things, but we wouldn't be remembering Jesus. We wouldn't be worshiping Jesus. We wouldn't be serving Jesus. We wouldn't even be reading about Jesus, because he would have never existed. But God's got a plan. We thank God for his plan. If we can encourage you today to live for Christ, to live according to his plan, to surrender your life, to say, God, I want to be used by you. If you want to obey the gospel, to be baptized so that your sins can be forgiven, start again, born again, a brand new start. We're going to stand. We'll sing together. Let us know how we can serve you today.